If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
But having no purpose was kind of depressing, actually. So after a few months of waking up and just goofing off every day, I decided to be productive and get more serious about real estate.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Paul Williams started investing in real estate in 2001. He originally started as a single-family landlord and house flipper and later moved into retail and office space investing and finally into multifamily investing. After gaining experience by investing in several multifamily properties, Paul joined the Multifamily Geeks team as a partner and works as the company's visionary. He is an owner and investor in single-family and multifamily properties totaling 612 units with a value of approximately $71 million in the Atlanta, Chicago, and Central Texas areas. Hey, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam.
It's great to have you on. Now, you're based in Austin, Texas, right?
Yes.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, you know, obviously the basic flow of the show, the same questions I ask everybody is, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there? Can you give us kind of that brief overview?
Sure. So I started investing in 2001 real estate as a college student. Just kind of did it as a hobby. After college, I started a trucking business, built that up. We ended up having offices in five or six states, employees all over the country. And I used the profits to continue investing in real estate. Come about 2016 or so, I was kind of getting bored with trucking, turned that over to one of our employees, and that business is still going. And I'm not a part of it, but from that point, I already had a number, you know, I had some commercial stuff, had rentals, and I just thought, well, I'll just work on real estate. So I've been full-time real estate since 2016.
That's interesting. So do you still own a part of that trucking company or did you sell it completely?
Nope. I totally got out of it.
Oh man. 2020, I would imagine would have been a great year to be in the trucking business.
I think so. I'm kind of out of tune on it now, but yeah.
Right. Interesting. Or at least in the logistics, you know, from all the online shopping and things like that. Well, that's interesting. So you went full-time real estate in 2016. What did that look like for you?
Well, after I left the trucking business, you know, I already had enough passive cash flow to, you know, to essentially be retired at, I guess I was 37 years old. But waking up every day with nothing to do, no purpose, you know, having achieved some of the dream things that I wanted, but having no purpose was kind of depressing, actually. So after a few months of waking up and just goofing off every day, I decided to be productive and get more serious about real estate.
Now that's interesting. So what was your first step? Now, obviously you think you still owned some real estate at this point in time, but what was the first thing you did?
Well, I guess I just started every day looking at, you know, real estate opportunities and, you know, developing some relationships with brokers and, you know, trying to get more strategic about my, what had been a hobby for 15 years. Yeah. I guess just getting more serious, you know, treating it more like a business instead of a hobby.
Okay. And tell us who are you as an investor? Who are you today? Like, what do you do today? If you started to treat it more as a business, where has it evolved to?
Well, I'm in land development and multifamily apartment syndication. So we're buying properties within a 4-hour drive of Atlanta. We are looking for things around Austin where I live, and we're doing land development in Central Texas.
Interesting. Okay. So land development and multifamily syndication around Atlanta. When it comes to land development, that's something that we don't hear a lot of, or we hear a lot of fear around land development. Can you tell us kind of why you guys do land development and what you're developing?
Well, I'm kind of a newbie at land development. A year ago, I came across 305 acres and it looked like a price I couldn't refuse. So I bought it and then I just cut it up into pieces and did some very basic infrastructure, surveyed it out and put it on the market. And it just happened to be at the perfect time. I bought it February of last year, about the time that people started eyeballing Texas more. you know, at that point, everybody wanted to move to Texas and everybody in Texas wanted to get some more land. So, you know, it just happened to be a grand slam. And I'm like, this is fun, not a lot of stress. And so I want to do more of it. So we basically sold off all of that development and just want to do more of that.
I gotcha. So you've got your focus really in two very different strategies.
Yeah.
Multifamily syndication, are you guys doing mostly value add? Are you buying Class A apartments or?
Well, we started out in like Class C and D, and it was just, you know, there's so much drama that goes along with that. And the returns look fantastic, but there's so many surprises and buildings burning down and people getting shot and police getting called out every couple of days. And there's just so much drama that even though the returns initially look wonderful, they, you know, they end up being worse than our Class B and A stuff. So started out in the C and D stuff, gradually moved over to the B and A. And so now we're doing some mostly B, but some Class A.
Gotcha. All right. So you've moved up in your multifamily syndication, you know, what you're buying, you've improved that. Let's circle the wagons back then to land development. So you know nothing about land development. You saw 305 acres and said, hey, I love that. Let's go buy it because it seems like a good deal, which is, I love the ready, fire, aim approach. It's the only way I can figure anything out. So good for you. So you bought the 305 acres. How did you decide what you were going to develop it into? How did you decide you had it surveyed for what? I mean, were you building, you know, mixed retail?
No, it's all commercial. It's all residential.
Okay.
I knew there was a high demand for land where we're at in Central Texas. Everybody wants some land. I surveyed it out into 10 acre pieces and just put in some basic infrastructure, electricity, and surveyed everything out, put in some roads, did some land clearing, and put it on the market. And, you know, the rest is history. So
how did you decide when to put in, you surveyed it out in 10 acre parcels. So your single family home, 10 acre parcels.
Yep.
That's a nice.
Yeah. Selling to the homeowners, not to developers.
Right. Okay. So you sold it to direct to homeowners, then they would bring their own builder and build it.
Yes. And during that process, I found that my neighbor had just bought 1,700 acres that he's splitting into small acre tracts and, 1 to 5 acres. And so we've developed a relationship and, you know, we're looking at now subdivision development and things like that. So, you know, we'll see how that all goes because I'm still kind of new at the land development. But, you know, I've been in business for a long time, been in real estate for a long time. So, you know, hopefully we know what to look out for.
Right. So talk to us, I guess, about underwriting that model. It sounds like pure speculation. How do you underwrite that?
Well, knowing that properties were selling for $10,000 to $12,000 an acre and me being able to buy it for $2,700 an acre, I didn't feel like there was a whole lot of risk in that. You know, so it's like, okay, there's money here. I don't know how it's going to be made, but there's an opportunity here. And whether instead of waiting for somebody else to figure it out and watching what they did, I'm like, I'm just going to do it.
Gotcha.
Which is not what we do in multifamily. In multifamily, it's like we got to see the path. You know, we don't, you know, there's no dice rolling there. It's, you know, we got to see the clear path to victory on the multifamily. But on this deal, I'm like, this works. We can make it happen.
What was it like working with the local municipalities in getting that approved? And I mean, I hear that can be a really exhaustive process.
You know, I think we got really lucky on this deal because I found out later that I should have done a whole lot more due diligence and talking to the city and the county. But everything just fell into place. We said, this is what we want to do. Talked to the surveyor. He's like, yep, you can do it. He got the blessing of the county and an email. And then once we divided it all up, there was a change of leadership. And the judge said, who said that this could all happen? And we said, well, here's the approval. And he's like, oh, okay. All right. Well, it works for me. So it really wasn't that hard. And, we were going to have people drilling wells and on the land. And then the city came back and said, well, we found out that there's a bigger water line available so you can have city water to all these lots. And, you know, the power was already there. We put in some basic gravel roads, did some land clearing, and, you know, which was a pretty small amount of money compared to the total, you know, project.
Right. So when I was thinking roads, I was thinking curbs and gutters and, you know, storm sewers. And I was thinking this was a full paved development, not cleared with some gravel roads. So that makes it a little more easier out of the gate.
I think we really got lucky on that whole deal.
Well, lucky and prepared. You took the initial step of seeing something for sale and hitting the buy button when, a lot of people, I think, would be still standing on the sidelines going, I wonder what the final sale price of all this would be. Did you just take that down in cash?
Yeah, that one I did by myself. On the syndications, we raise money and, get investors together. But that one, I don't want to have to explain this to anybody because, that my gut tells me we're going to make a lot of money.
Right.
And it was such a good deal. I'm like, I'm just going to do this myself.
Right. You could have done nothing but sit on it and put a for sale sign in the yard and probably, tripled your money. So that's fantastic. Good for you. Let's talk a little bit, change gears here off of land development and talk about what you guys are doing in the multifamily space. Obviously, this is a hot topic right now. I feel like everybody that I know is doing multifamily. And I just really want to hear what you guys, where you have seen since 2016 when you got into real estate, where you have seen things come from and take into account, I guess, what happened in 2020 and maybe even now part of 21, and just kind of get your feel for where this is going. You have any insights on that?
Well, I actually got into commercial in 2014, but I was not full-time until 2016, like just solely focused on real estate. And I'm glad that I realized that since 2014, that's only 7 years. That's not a long, long time, but I know you're right. It seems like everybody you talk to, they've been in, either in syndication and, a lot of them have just been at this for, two or three years. And it's easy to ride the wave from just the last two or three years. Where is this all going? It's really hard to tell with all the money printing, eviction moratoriums. There's just so many things going on in the market with people moving out of the cities, moving to, kind of out of the cities because so many people can work from home now. You've got interest rates super low. You get non-recourse debt for, around 3%. 3.25%, 3.5%. I think we're going to see some good opportunities. I mean, we find good opportunities even in a time like this, but they're just fewer and further between. But I think we'll see some really good deals in the next year or two as people are feeling the pressure, not paying not being able to pay their obligations, especially with some of the people that have a interest only with a balloon that they got 3 years ago, and now that's come due. So I think we'll see some good opportunities.
How have your properties performed through 2020? And what did you guys do to mitigate maybe an onslaught of non-paying tenants?
Well, surprisingly, we've done well. We have one property that has taken a bit of a hit. Actually, two properties that have taken a bit of a hit. We got one property in Branson, Missouri that is, it's totally driven by tourism. And that's kind of a lower end property. Most of the people there are in, the blue collar workforce. And so, we've had some issues with non-payment and stuff, but we got it at such a good price to start with that, we were okay. We just had some non-cash flowing months. So that one's taken a bit of a hit. Seems to be coming back now. We were working on a refinance and it appraised for 25-30% more than we bought it for. Mm. And so we're actually refinancing, getting a much lower rate because we got the loan 3 years ago. And, our payments are going down. We're getting some cash out. So that was taking a hit, but it's still doing okay overall. And then we've got one in Birmingham that we've had a higher delinquency, but, we've got a ton of equity in that one. So even with not being able to evict, we're still doing just fine, surprisingly. We definitely had some concerns, March, April of last year. Where is this all going? But we don't have C&D assets, so I think there's a lot more stability in the B stuff that we're in. People figure out a way to pay their bills, and so we really haven't been too affected. But I imagine the C&D assets are probably telling a different story.
Right, right. That's interesting. Has your strategy changed at all moving into 2021? is what you guys want to acquire? Has that changed in light of the events of 2020?
Yes, it has. We're wanting to get even better, nicer assets that are going to be even more resilient. Yes, we may take a little bit of a hit on the overall returns, but I think, you know, we'll see more stability. And then we're also just trying to get things in line to where we can jump on some of these opportunities, have the liquidity to when hopefully we start seeing some really fantastic opportunities in the next year or two, that we will have the liquidity and we're just totally set up to where we can jump on some of these deals.
What are some strategies you're using to establish that liquidity?
That's a good question. That's what we're trying to do. What are we doing? We're refinancing some of our properties. We're doing cash out refinances into some more longer term debt, taking some of that cash out. And we're kind of, you know, we're always looking for good deals, but, you know, knowing that we may see some great deals in the next, you know, 6 to 18 months, we're freeing up some of that cash through cash out refinances, you know, just hopefully having that liquidity to be able to jump on the deals. Cause I was in real estate back in 2010, 11, 12, and I was kind of cautious at that time. And I was only buying things that I could buy with cash. I wasn't doing any bank financing back then. And looking back, man, I sure would love to be able to buy stuff at 2009 and 10 and 11, 12 pricing. So I don't want to miss that window again. I was kind of cautious back in the last cycle.
So a lot of times you'll see, the either in the prospectus or you know the documents that are sent to the passive investor that, hey, you know, we look to cash out, refinance, you know, once we get the property stabilized, once we get rents up, things like that, we'll cash out, refinance, and return that cash to the investors. Right, that's kind of one of the big draws, is that you can refinance these, we get our money out, and yet then continue, especially as passive investors, to receive income on, you know, on money that we no longer have deployed. How do you guys have that discussion, and how do you decide how much to keep? And if you are giving any back, how does that work when you say, hey, look, we cashed out, refied this property, but we're going to take that, you know, whatever it is, $1 million we got on the refinance, but we're just going to set that aside as dry powder for future acquisitions. How does that work?
Well, that can be difficult because, you know, we're bound to do what was written in the documents that the investors agreed to.
Right.
So I'm trying to keep myself liquid personally, but then as we deliver great returns to our investors, you know, the hope and the idea is that they will continue to invest with us. Oh, you doubled my money in 3 years. Here, we'll take this money and do something with it. And, you know, our relationships are built on trust and the long term. We don't do really advertising to bring in, most of our stuff is 506B, but we've done some 506C. You know, so we can't advertise on the open market that we have deals. So we build a lot of relationships. And so by delivering those great returns, our investors invest again. Some of them have been investing with us for, you know, 3, 4, 5 deals in a row. So.
Gotcha. That's interesting. Man, this is great. Any lessons that you have learned, either mistakes you've done or mistakes you've made or things that you've done right? Any key lessons in the last, I guess, as you rewind the tape, you know, 4 or 5 years that you'd want to share?
Yeah, I guess, you know, if you see a great deal and then, you know, don't be afraid to jump on it. But the deals that you look at, I would say you want a disproportionate risk reward ratio. You know, as back years ago when I had a job, which was in the early 2000s, was the last time I worked for somebody else. They would say, you know, do you want to contribute whatever it was, some money to the 401k? And you can choose from these different categories. Do you want the high growth, high risk? Do you want the low growth, low risk? But what we look for is the high upside with limited downside. So best case, you do fantastic. Worst case, you don't lose, or you don't lose much, you know? So we want to look for the disproportionate, not high risk, high reward. We want to look for high reward, low risk. Mm-hmm. So I would just say, look for those disproportionate opportunities and don't be afraid to, when you see a great deal, to just go for it. And if you've got multiple exit strategies, if you're stuck holding on to it and you're getting great cash flow, then it really doesn't matter what the economy does. But when you're banking on nothing changing for the next 2 or 3 years, except continuing to go up, if something changes, then You can be like the, what was it? The guy that's swimming naked. And then it's all fine until the tide came out and exposed him. You know, so I think you want to be, you know, look at it in such a way, not that you're going to find, well, let me think of how to say this. Some people are banking on things continuing to rise. And as long as it does, you know, they buy, even though they think it's at the top, they're like, well, I bet I can buy it and sell it, you know, in the short period of time later, even though it's overpriced now, somebody will pay a higher price. There's a, what they call it, a bigger, I can't remember what they call it, but they're like a bigger dummy, you know, it's like
a greater fool or something to that effect.
Yeah, greater fool. That's the term, you know. So they buy it too high, thinking that it's going to continue going to, you know, even higher. But I think that's kind of a bad way because, you know, what if you bought it at the very top, you know, and then if you got other people involved in it, then I don't know, it's just bad all the way around. But right. If you're buying on solid numbers, then it doesn't matter. Oh, if we end up holding it for 5 years longer or 3 years longer, hey, we're fine. We're getting cash flow. We're making an acceptable return.
Right. That's great. Let's jump into the final four here if we can, Paul. The first would be if you were giving one piece of advice to an aspiring investor, what would that one piece of advice be?
I would just say to go for it. There's a lot of people that want to analyze, and never do anything. And, you know, we miss out on a lot of opportunities just because we're waiting and watching. You know, if you've already been waiting, watching, you're, you know, evaluating deals and you got a good understanding, just go for it. Yes, you're going to make some mistakes. Yes, you know, maybe you thought you were going to get this return and you got a little bit less. You know, you got to get started at some point. Ideally, you'll get started with somebody that knows a whole lot more than you, has high integrity, and, you know, can help you along in that process to save you from, you know, from getting hurt.
Right, right. That's great. What's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
Well, I went to a mastermind last week, you know, trying to always get around people that are smarter than me. They say if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Mm-hmm. So getting up around people that are further down the road than me, you know, I try to always be reading books and listening to things to keep me sharp.
That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing to make the world a better place?
Well, we're doing a few things, but one thing is we're giving people a great place to live at a fair price, improving their, you know, their enjoyment of life by giving them a great place to stay. You know, we also do some giving to orphanages and feeding centers around the world. My goal this year is to take 2 mission trips and, you know, to hopefully help out some people. And so you asked for one, but you got a few.
No, that's great. That's great. Paul, if listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Well, they can go to multifamilygeeks.com. They can find us on Facebook, Multifamily Geeks Invest. Yeah, if they want to reach out, I mean, they can give me a call, shoot me a text. My phone number is 219-629-5588. They can reach me at paul@hcshomes.com. Yeah, love to, you know, have a conversation with anybody that wants to talk about real estate or business or life in general. So
that's awesome, Paul. Thank you so much for your time and thanks for coming on.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.